Vault Talk, episode one of the Fallout TV show. Let's get our thoughts and what's going on. What is the name of this episode, Jess? That is my first and most confusing question, because the Amazon app says something, and then when the first episode hops on screen, it says something else. And I'm like, that must be the title of this segment of the
Each episode does have a title. Also, every episode, they put up the Fallout name and it disappears or happens in a different sort of way. I like how they're kind of making it individual and creative like that. So the name of this episode is The End.
The End. I see, according to the Amazon app, it says okidoki... is the name of the episode. And when I started the episode, it said The End. So is The End the name of this first segment of the first episode, or is the Amazon app stupid?
Oh, that's interesting. Now, what Amazon app are you using to watch?
I'm on Roku TV, just the Amazon Prime video app or whatever.
Okay, and I'm on the Amazon Prime app on Xbox, and it says The End for me. I wonder if it just uses a quote from the episode.
Is the Amazon app on Xbox super, super duper frustrating to use, as in like...
No, it's lovely.
Oh God, I hate it on my TV. Maybe I need to switch over to Xbox then, because I hit, oh my God, I missed that. I end up hitting it four times and it skips back 8 minutes. And I'm like,
yeah, you can do the 10 second skip back, 30 second skip back, whatever it is, but you can also just rewind or fast forward. It's very easy to navigate. How are you guys watching it? Ray, Will, are you guys on the PC? What app do you use to watch your Amazon Prime?
I'm on Roku. And
I'm just using my PC for it.
Okay, perfect. So you're using Roku too, Ray.
Yeah.
And do you find the app is frustrating?
No.
Mine just doesn't behave. I don't know. And I upgraded internet recently too and everything. We should have a speedy, super duper internet. I don't know what the deal is.
Well, everybody listening, just so you know what we're doing, this is Vault Talk episode one, as Andrew said. I am here with Andrew, Ray, and Will, and we are going over this episode titled The End of the Fallout TV show. We are recording these after we do our regular episode of the Fallout feed, so we're a couple hours in right now. But I just figured I want to make sure to introduce us to anyone listening to just this episode.
We're going to get punchy and forget to introduce each other.
Indeed. And the pug, as you may have heard, is restless. So speaking about restless people at parties and events, this episode starts off at a birthday party. And we are seeing this guy, Cooper Howard, and his daughter. He's performing some tricks. He is using a lasso. And you're getting the sense of where they're at. It's an affluent kid's birthday party. Why is a big Hollywood actor here? Someone's kind of talking about it. Alimony, says the other.
One of the things I liked about this first scene was they popped out the ProSnap camera. That was one of the first things. I was like, ooh, reference. Like, I'm sure there's been other references already. I think you overhear Codsworth's voice, the Mr. Handy's voice at some point. And then do they let you catch a glimpse of them?
Yeah.
In this scene? They do? Okay.
Yeah. So when the mom was coming out of the kitchen, he offers to help.
What are they watching on TV? They also were watching like Grognak and the Chris Ruby.
Yeah. They're flipping around and there's a weather report at first, because this is after they take the picture when Cooper won't pose with his thumbs out. One of them whispers the other that, oh, he's some kind of commie, because he wouldn't do the all-American vault boy thumb thing.
It's because of his Hollywood connections or something.
A little bit of both, I think. But on the TV, we first see a weather report and the weatherman starts to talk about the weather. And he's like, I can't do this with everything going on in the world right now. And that's how, between that and Cooper not doing the thumbs up, we know that the world is not in a good place right now. They're on the precipice of nuclear war. But they switch over to Grognak. That's what they start watching, which, great reference.
That was awesome, yeah. And they started the whole show with Orange Colored Sky. So the soundtrack, one of the things I'd been wondering before they played them was, were they going to use songs from the game? So I was satisfied like 1 second into the show.
That really is brilliant. Using Orange Colored Sky right off. Such a great song, too. So they're at the birthday and life is normal. And he's talking to his daughter about the thumb thing. That technically, so when the Vault Boy thumbs up, okay, the Apocrypha, the fan theory, and one of the big reasons for it that people talk about is about the size of a nuke blast behind your thumb. You put up your thumb if you see a big bomb. And if your thumb covers it, you're okay. But if it's bigger than your thumb, well, you're probably not going to be okay. No need to run because it's too late.
Running, yeah. You have time to run if it's smaller than your thumb.
In reality, when they designed the Vault Boy for the original Fallout, they hadn't been thinking of that at the time. They just wanted an optimistic, kind of cheery, thumbs up character. But that became incorporated into the mythology of Fallout. And of course, now here it is in the show too. But Tim Kaine in interviews has said that that was not the original idea, but it's been adopted and accepted now. So that comes in very handy because when the father goes inside to get a piece of cake for his daughter.
What was the first instance of that being used in the series games then?
Oh, I don't know. They've ever actually said it in a game.
Yeah. Where did that come from then?
I believe it was a real thing. Articles go back all the way to the mid 2015 with Fallout 4 coming out. And so it's just kind of a fan theory that happened. And I don't know. It's ever been said in the game. And I do know that the creator said that it was not the original plan.
But it is a real thing. That's fun. Mm-hmm. Where are we? Birthday party.
Everybody's scrambling.
Oh, right. It sees the bomb. Oh, yeah. Is that my thumb or yours?
Yeah, that was such a good line that the daughter, she's watching a blast and Cooper turns around and he doesn't think it could actually be a nuclear blast. But no, then a mushroom cloud shows up and the blast wave is approaching and he anchors and boom, it comes through, blows out the glass. Everybody in the party starts screaming and they start running. It was so intense. I mentioned last episode that I teared up a bit and this is where it happened because it's just like the intro to Fallout 4, the whole pre-war thing, the idea of everybody panicking, running from the blast, and you see the nuke on the horizon. Pretty intense.
I guess I didn't realize that cities had multiple bombs dropped on them. I always thought Boston had like one major one for like the glowing sea, but it looked like Los Angeles, or I assume that's Los Angeles. Is that where they are?
Yeah. Yep.
They had four. Right there, according to the show.
Does make sense on some major cities with the low-yield nuclear bombs and the large city like that covers a huge area. So
yeah, but LA is a huge area.
Boston, we know of both the Cambridge crater is a really huge crater. There is, of course, the glow where probably larger bombs or multiple bombs went down, where we have that area. But chances are there are some that we aren't even aware of where they may have not created as large of a crater or faded to time. So I imagine major cities were hit by one or more bombs in most cases.
Yeah. In Fallout 1, you know, when we go through the Boneyard, everything is destroyed. So,
right. With the glow kind of being a little bit on this very southeast side, and then the Boneyard section being more like the centered and north side of LA, kind of. It's a large area, like you're saying, which is going to be covered in the show because it all takes place in and around greater LA for the most part. So, interestingly, after this, it's a really quick switch. Anything else you wanted to mention in this first scene, Andrew? Or
any references that I missed? The Grognak, the Mr. Handy.
There was a Sugar Bombs commercial too, I think.
Sugar Bombs commercial, cool. Yeah. I like to point out all the fun references. That's good.
And then we get the Fallout intro. So it's this most intense, affecting moment. Then you get the Fallout popping up on screen. And immediately we cut to 219 years later. We're in Vault 33 with Lucy McLean, and she is telling us about her random role for her character build, where she's going through.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah.
It's like she was listening to our show, wasn't she?
Is she going to be okay with melee? She can, or she's gun and, or more unarmed rather than
riflery.
Melee.
Like, yeah, so her perception must be very high.
I love the whole. So what she's doing is talking to the board about petitioning for maybe finding a marriage partner from one of the other connected vaults. And we're like, wait, connected vault? Okay, this is odd. But yeah,
she's a new concept, right?
Totally going through her specials and perks. And I love the fact that with the riflery, she says, "No, I'm not very good," and yet you actually see her.
Right, it's all dead center.
Pretty close to it. She obviously excels, but she's trying to downplay her skills. So this is where we get, okay, she's outgoing. She's very skilled, very intelligent. And the vaults, the whole interconnected vault, that is definitely a new thing that I was confused by at first. Are they going to send out like some kind of party across the waste? If she's petitioning for someone to marry here in Vault 33 from Vault 32, how far away is it?
Yeah, I was absolutely confused too. I was like, wait, so are they already doing surface things? Because she talks about the triannual trade or something that they do, right? So
exactly. There are three vaults. Vault 31, Vault 32, and Vault 33 are connected. And they sometimes do cultural or marriage exchanges.
Trades.
You see that later on when they go through the list of exchanges. They are every 3 years.
Oh, okay.
Is it every 3 years?
That's what I got out of it.
Okay. So yeah, I didn't know
you don't see it in this episode, but you do see it later.
And we do. We get the poster depicting the three vaults and how they're connected, interdependent with crops and people. So it talks about the Young Pipe Fitters Association that she's on with her closest friend, Steph, who we're going to meet later in the episode.
I like that. That was kind of like a Rosie the Riveter type deal with her wrench, unless she gave like the strong woman pose. Yes. It was really cool.
It really was. And her friend, Steph, who is the pregnant blonde lady we've seen in all the previews and stuff like that, she is kind of vault girl. Like, she is so classic vault girl with that blonde haircut and the vault suit. But yeah, she talks about science, speech, history, ethics, gymnastics, fencing, intermediate phys ed, riflery, walks with dad.
Intermediate phys ed was my favorite. I was like, all right.
Gardening with dad, book club with dad. And you also get from this that vault life is a little bit sheltered. She ends up doing a lot of stuff with her father. Because they're just very, very close. You don't see her mother mention any of this. She also mentions her reproductive organs are intact, hygiene, well-maintained. So we finish all this, and she is approved, which is excellent. So we get her walking out and talking to her friend, Steph, and they're all excited about what's going to be happening. And she mentions the two words that I will never forget. Cousin Steph.
Cousin Steph.
She says, after years of cousin stuff, she's excited for the real thing. So one assumes, and God, I can't imagine it's regular, but I think I told you guys when that happened, I paused and I spent a good 10 minutes looking up cousin stuff as slang, like 50 slang. Like, is there a way out of this? Does she mean something other than what I think she means?
No, of course she does. Like, I immediately took it as such. Why did you not want to believe? Was it that, of course, they would have to? I guess you've not played enough Fallout Shelter. That's all I'm saying.
Oh, my goodness gracious. But no. I mean, what does cousin stuff really mean? Like, it's not like necessarily...
There's lots of accidental breeding. You're like, ooh.
One assumes...
Those two are not supposed to be left in the room together. My bad.
One assumes you only have so many people in your age group, okay? And cousin stuff, I mean, a lot of people in a vault, especially a smaller vault, there's a minimum population to be viable and diverse, 500 people or more. But these vaults seem a little bit smaller. Okay.
I think, right?
Yeah. And we don't know the exact size of this vault, but that sounds good. But a lot of people are going to be a second cousin, a third cousin. So we're not talking first cousin stuff. Okay. We're talking second or third cousin stuff. But one of the people closest to her age, as we find out in a little bit, is Chet. And Chet has the hots for her pretty hard. Uh-huh. Cousin stuff is like first or second base. Okay. I mean, I don't know.
You really don't want them to have, you know, bumped uglies.
Don't worry, they make it more clear later.
He said it's let Mo not a long-term viable sexual practice, right? Isn't that what she
says? That is what she says later. Yeah. So we're getting the wedding prep. We learn about Steph and Bert's relationship, Steph being her good friend, and the line, I love this. On my wedding night, the dress got off faster than Bert did. But this is where we know that it's an adult show. So they walk out into the quaint countryside set, the whole projector.
I mean, I know that we've seen that before, like in the robot bunker where they project the beach scene and stuff like that, or they have the beach. We've seen the projector things to represent the outside. I just really like how that looks. They're sort of, it's like they're putting on a play and they know it almost, where it's like the first three rows of corn are real, but then the rest of them are painted on the set behind them. You know what I mean? Like, it's kind of funny. They have it set up like a pretend play. That's part of the charm of it. You know what I mean?
It makes sense when you're underground. We've seen that with overseer windows and other stuff in the past where looking out on a fake world or countryside. Here they actually have it in the atrium. Well, one assumes it's the atrium. I mean, there's a lot of the vault we don't see, but we do see a good bit. And it's very Fallout 4 looking. You know, the props here, the food, the vault, everything is very Fallout 4 feeling. I thought the atrium was really cool.
Absolutely.
So some time passes, and then you see them setting up for a wedding at this point, and they're going to meet people from Vault 32. So communication has happened back and forth between their vault and the other vault. There is someone over there who is part of the triennial thing and is going to come over to get married to Lucy.
And Steph is jealous.
So they get there to the door, and this is where we learn that Chet is the cousin, that she's been cousin stuff.
I like Chet. He's fun.
He's great, but he goes to open the door and he says it's busted. Pushes the button, taps the button.
He's like, oh, darn. Shucks, it won't open.
Yeah, the Tumblr jam.
I love it. Oh, and
it needs to open up an issue of the Tumblrs today.
And that's where she has the line. Everybody's kind of looking. They know what Chet's up to because he goes over and he's like, Lucy, I love you. She's like, yes, we all know that, Chet.
We all know, Chet. We know that.
Yeah. Messing around with your cousin is well and good for when we're kids, but not a sustainable long-term sexual practice.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's so good.
They open the door. And so it opens. There are a bunch of vault dwellers from Vault 32 kind of standing a silhouette in the doorway. Immediately, it feels a little ominous because the vault's dark. Yes. It's a little dark. Mm-hmm. They very quickly foreshadow that not all is as it should be here. But apparently, our vault dwellers don't know. So they welcome them in, bring them over, and they're going to, they introduce Lucy to her groom-to-be. What is his name? Monty?
Monty.
And he is the hot hubby. And this is where Steph says, lucky. So Monty, I mean, he looks like a bit emo.
He's got that, like, that downward gaze. It's like a little, like you said, ominous. He's menacing looking, like he won't look up. Kind of.
Maybe he's just shy, but they're all kind of skinny.
Yeah, I just remember they're covered in tattoos.
They go in, the wedding starts, they're speechifying. We're seeing them eating all together. And during this, you can catch very quickly, eating with their knives. We're seeing tattoos up on necks. We're seeing a little bit of scarring on people. So it's pretty clear to those of us watching that they're not regular vault dwellers. The brother notices pretty quickly that something is wrong here.
So he actually wanders off and goes to the other vault to have a look around, sees the destroyed crops and then the corpse, and realizes that something's up.
Yeah, something's definitely up when he's investigating there, because it's dead. And they mentioned there was blight on their crops and such. That's why they're getting some seed during the exchange. But oh my gosh, seed.
There was also the mention that the previous overseer had died. So they hadn't interacted with this new overseer that introduced
them. They said, we received your telegram or something. I thought that was a weird phrasing. Is that what they call their terminal communiques? Are those telegrams?
It seems to be, yeah. But the speech, let's see. Hank, the overseer's speech, he says, we are bonded, not just as neighbors, with a shared duty to keep the candle of civilization lit while the rest of the world has been passed off in darkness. Radiation levels are dropping fast enough. Monty and Lucy's children may be able to recolonize the surface. So that's big news. You get the sense of what the people in the vault are all about, that they are keeping the spirit of America alive. They're going to get out there and recolonize. That is the whole kind of Vault Tech mission. But especially in this vault, like, we know that not all vaults were quite so gung-ho with Vault Tech's mission. But right here, it seems like this could be a control vault. No weird experiments, unless it has to do with the exchange of people.
That was the impression I got very early also. Control.
But meanwhile, Lucy and Monty have retired to their chamber because Monty is eager to get it on.
See where he's going to live.
So I thought this scene was, I mean, Monty's obviously very eager, but it's understandable. So Lucy's not suspicious. She's just okie dokie. And they get to it. But this is also when she starts to realize, after stuff has happened, he's getting up and he abuses the curtains. And he's there playing with the faucet as though he hasn't seen running water before or often, and turning it on and off. And then he ends up drinking out of a big old pitcher. And that's when Lucy gets suspicious. She pulls out her Pip-Boy and he's radioactive.
And so I think already at this point, can you hear gunshots in the background too? A little
bit? I think, like, at that point it's starting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So she realizes it's radioactive. And so the fight breaks out.
And about that too, because when she breaks out the Pip-Boy, which was no smart move to do to see if he has any radioactive, he's like very radioactive. If he's giving off that much radiation, would he, you know, like, still be sort of that normal and healthy?
I think it's interesting. I think the idea is that because they're in the vault at this point with the Pip-Boy still, and there's almost none, that there's pretty heavily calibrated that it would be pretty sensitive to almost any rads, you know?
Okay.
I guess in reality, like ours, if you don't look at the meter that shows up there that seemed to be high, it'll click at even less than one, but some rads detected.
Yeah. Well, because his, I was looking at the meter and it's all the way in the solid.
Right. It's not logical. And in fact, if the Pip-Boys were like that heavily calibrated in the wasteland, it would never stop. right? It would never stop picking up the rats.
Yeah, and it seemed like that was reading at different levels. So that was reading the external. We normally see the radiation as it's affecting us, not just what's the surrounding radiation like, which that seemed to be what this meter was reading.
Yeah, so that's definitely different. Using it like a Geiger counter, pointing it at something as opposed to like in your personal radiation bubble and such. So they did treat that a little bit differently. And I definitely wouldn't pay attention to the meter because that seemed pretty high. But they fight. And it's quite an intense fight. This is where we realize that the bloody mess perk is in full effect here. I won't go blow by blow, but a lot of slicing. It's very, it's kind of horrifying to think these two were just intimate.
That phys ed now class paid off for her.
They're here trying to kill each other. He's trying to choke her to death.
It's a glass pitcher. And that was another thing. We talk a lot about just how spot on a lot of the items in the show are as compared to the game. And just that made me happy too, that just even seeing that glass pitcher, because the glass pitchers are in Fallout 3 and 4 mm-hmm. and all that, you know, so.
Yeah. That's such a classic picture. Yeah. Also, the stove that she's sitting on gets put up on while she's being choked to death with an Atomic Queen stove. So I love all these little references and brand names and stuff.
All so good.
Mm-hmm. So there, let's see. After that, ultimately, she ends up putting him down, right?
The face.
All right. Is that better?
Yeah. We can hear you now. Are you on your phone now or something?
Yeah. I had a switch over. Couldn't get the board to turn back on. Sorry about that. Please continue. Okay.
So after Lucy gets through there, she gets over to the armory and sees the armory has been raided. And this is something that I had trouble with on first viewing, but watching a couple times, I've kind of figured out now. While we only see like the 5 or up to 7 Vault 32 people, or raiders as we're now considering them, at the wedding, there seems to be a lot more carnage going on. How are these at least 50 vault dwellers we see here, but probably more than that in the vault itself, being so destroyed? We know that they're not prepared. They're taken unawares because of the wedding. But then I realized it's not just the 5 to 7 that were at the wedding, but there were others in Vault 32 that came through, that broke in, ransacked the armory, and have all these guns and weapons now. So I think in reality, there's probably a good 20 of them. As we find out later, there's at least 6 in captivity that they have imprisoned. So it was actually a bit of a bloodbath and are really, really hurting people. And so Norm comes into this. Lucy comes into this. Lucy wearing the bandolier and wedding dress. I love that. We need that outfit in Fallout 76.
Have it in a shelter, right? No. She's in a vault suit. Never mind.
And she's using a trank gun or a syringer kind of weapon.
Yeah, she has a trank pistol, actually, right?
She doesn't want to hurt people. But of course, it's total chaos.
I just assumed that was all that was left in the armory.
I also love that when she got stabbed, she's got this knife and she pulls the knife out. She goes in the bathroom and there gets a stim pack out of the med kit.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And shoots herself with the stim pack and now she's doing okay.
Glad they have those references in there and actually make that work. Yeah. Yep.
Well, and her use of the syringe pistol also keeps her a sympathetic character because she's not killing people. You know what I mean? It keeps her on the light and bubbly side.
Yeah. She does shoot the one guy in the eye, but...
but that's just fun.
So with the fighting breaks out, things I really thought was neat about this. When the projector gets hit and the film starts melting, the way that it took that idyllic scene and made it look like multiple nuke clouds and things being destroyed, kind of like echoing this opening scene, that was really cool. We also saw Fallout references.
I was thinking in Jet, yeah.
Yeah.
The one guy, he does Jet, right? With the Jet inhaler, for sure. Mm. Dad comes in and helps fight. They help put him down. And then Monty shows back up and he's not dead, but he is missing a lot of his jaw. Very cut up. Very rough shape. So they start fighting. Dad comes in. No longer as handsome. No. Dad comes in and they start tussling and Dad puts Monty down.
Yeah, after he whacked him with a shovel.
Face first and a jar of pickles. Barrel of pickles, yeah, with a shovel. I got it. Just looking at the wounds on his face, I was just thinking about how much that pickle juice would burn.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I know he dies by drowning, but like, oh, the pain. I will never look at pickles the same again. All this happens, and the Vault Dwellers seem to be finally getting the upper hand as they're putting down some of the raiders that are here and subduing them. Do you guys remember exactly how they got to where a bunch of people are being held at the entrance to Vault 32?
They just ran off out the room down like a corridor.
Her dad got a message on his Pip-Boy saying that the inner vault door was being accessed.
They went to the door, Hank and Lucy, and that's where they saw a number of the raiders there had several other people we'd met so far in the vault on their knees, bound and surrounded by some bombs. This is where the overseer from Vault 32, who we now know isn't really an overseer. Does she say her name at this point?
She had said her name when she first introduced herself. She's like, I am Lee Moldaver, overseer from Vault 32, when they very first met them, because this is something you're getting to that I actually had a question on. Because he's like, I know who you are. And she says, everyone knows who I am. Or he says, I think I know who you are. And so I'm wondering, how much did he just know of, like, this position she held, or if he really knows of who she might be? Like, she said her name.
Yeah, at this point in the story, we don't know. We have no idea, but it does seem Hank suddenly seems to recognize her now, and he didn't before. And she says, everybody knows me. So we're like, okay, what does that mean? That's ominous. And then she says, but do they know who they are? Okay, what does any of this mean? And we don't have answers at this point.
No, nope.
We don't. It's very suspicious. But then she says, what, she's making Hank basically choose, you know, am I going to take Lucy or am I going to take them? And at first I was like, ooh, bad overseer, because he's not my daughter. And he grabs her and he shoves her into a room closed behind a glass door. I'm like, is he basically saying kill the rest of my people here in the door and not Lucy?
Yes. But then
that's what I was thinking. Yeah.
That's what you took out of it too.
Yeah. Bad overseer, good dad.
No, he's giving himself up, of course. Come on.
And that's what actually happens, is he gives himself up. He's pulled through. Lucy has to watch. And they set the bombs on a timer. And so everybody kind of has to run to escape.
And so that is at least decent of her there for raiders to let them run off.
Mm-hmm. It seems like, I mean, they definitely killed people in the vault. The people with her are vicious. The whole thing was over the top. But she didn't kill any more people at the door. She gave them a chance to run while she just took the overseer. So the question to me was, why did they want Hank? What at that point, why did they want him as a captive or to kidnap him? Like, what was the goal here? Was it just to raid the vault, get weapons and stuff? Was it just because they found themselves in Vault 32 and they were using it as a headquarters? Like, I didn't know.
And of course, there's also that line coming up here. Just as they're leaving, she goes up to the door that Lucy's stored in. And Lee Moldaver, she's like, you look like your mother.
Right. How does she know? This whole thing is beyond bizarre.
If you look, you know, 7 episodes down the road, I would be highly insulted.
So it just raises all kinds of questions. How did she know Hank? How did Hank know her? How did she know Lucy's mom? All of that is a mystery to us, but mystery for another day, because the explosion happens, stuff crashes down, and we switch scenes. And now
being beat up.
Johnny Cash is playing. A guy is getting beaten out in the California desert. Does it say, like, Brotherhood of Steel at the Air Force Base?
Yeah, they raised the flag.
So we know it's the Brotherhood because they raised the flag and we're on a new location on an Air Force Base. We see Maximus getting whooped. And the people look like military, but like training.
What are they called? Yeah. Aspirants or something?
Aspirants.
And that surprised me too. So we know it's the Brotherhood. So we got Maximus, and after he's getting beaten up and the others take off, his friend Dane shows up. And they're called Aspirant Dane. I thought his name was Aspirin at first. I'm like, why? Why are they calling Aspirin Dane? But okay, I just read like Aspirin. But
he just has lots of headaches.
Right after that, they go into the classroom where you learn about the mission of the Brotherhood being to collect and preserve pre-war technology. And then the one guy, the elder, he even shows a schematic or something to Maximus. He's like, do you know what this is? And of course, he calls it something else that was wrong. And
right.
Circuitry, and, you know, he chastises him and all that. Glimpse of what they're learning.
Brotherhood training here, that these aspirants are training to be squires, to be part of the Brotherhood. Dane and Maximus and all of them. We don't know everybody's names yet, but you can tell there's a group of a good probably 10 to 15 aspirants here in training.
That many.
How many of these actors have you guys recognized so far? Like, there's the Kyle MacLachlan, of course. And, like, I feel like I recognize this elder guy for the BOS here.
Yeah, he's definitely a well-known actor.
I feel like tons of these faces I recognize. Like, they're doing a good job of not making it super famous people.
We talked about it last week, how it was bringing you out of it for some of them, like, overall throughout the course of the show, but there aren't that many yet for me.
Yeah, just Dad for the most part, I guess.
Definitely. And so, the actor who plays Dane is Zelia Mendez-Jones, and they were in, I believe, Wheel of Time?
My wife recognized the brother, too.
Oh, Norm, Moises Arias. Yeah, he has been in a number of things.
Yeah. All right, sorry to interrupt.
No, that's good. That's a good question. Like, how many have we seen so far? Not a lot, but definitely some. But I like the way that we do learn through this scene, you know, that they are in the Brotherhood. They are training. The Brotherhood's about collecting technology, which, of course, we know, but not everyone watching will. This whole aspirant thing, really, you get the sense as it goes on that this area they're at is really kind of a supply base, like supply and training barracks. That if they're even a full chapter here, which I don't know that they are, I think they're part of a chapter, that this is more about supply and training and a little bit out of the way.
This is like a boot camp, if anything, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what happens is while they're in that training, in that classroom, that's when they get interrupted and you see the big, well, first you just see the shadow of the ship coming in overhead. And that's when they all run outside and they see what appears from Fallout 4. It looks much like the Pridwin in Fallout 4. And then get a first glimpse of the knights coming down.
Vertebrates coming in, the knights walking.
Yes, in their power armor.
And I don't know if it was legit or not, but I saw a close-up picture of that and it says Pridwin on the side.
Yeah, and we didn't know ahead. This was a big misdirect, big old trick. We learned in the Vanity Fair article that, oh, it's the Caswinon is what it's called. It's a ship like the Pridwin. We get all that. We see a few photos, blah, blah, blah. Like, we're like, okay, this is weird. Why does West Coast BOS have another airship? Because we know it was made from specific parts. It was put together over the course of several years by the East Coast Brotherhood that Maxon runs. But it turns out, Ray, it is the Pridwin. It was all lies. All lies. This is from the East Coast. Or at least the Pridwin has made it over here with these knights.
It can't be, because if they played Fallout 4 like I did, the Pridwin is no more.
Well, and so it's either been rebuilt somewhat, like the blowing up wasn't quite as extreme as we thought, or it does imply, if not canonize an ending, that either the Brotherhood were victorious, or a Minuteman ending. Whatever happened, the Pridwin wasn't fully destroyed, and the chapter seems to be there because it is mentioned at another point, the Commonwealth is brought up. And when it was first brought up as the Commonwealth, I thought, and I'm telling Ray, like, well, all of them are technically Commonwealths. There are 13 Commonwealths in the U.S. now. But no, it was the Commonwealth. So yeah, these are from the East Coast Brotherhood. Now, we don't know how many chapters there are spread out, how the Brotherhood is currently organized, but it does appear that here, this chapter seems to be recovering, and certainly they're coming in strength from the East Coast for a reason.
I'm not well-spoken in Fallout lore, of course, but I seem to remember one of the factions, I don't know if it was New Vegas or something, it could have been Fallout 1 even, where like the Fallout or the Brotherhood faction splintered off from the main and became ultra-religious and were zealots and all sorts of... Do you guys remember which game that would have been?
Fallout 3, yeah. Because we met them when we did Anchorage.
Right, that was the Outcasts.
The Outcasts. Cool.
Outcasts, which are a little bit more traditional Brotherhood message. West Coast Brotherhood, so there were more religious overtones when we met them in 1 and 2. The setup of the Brotherhood, we have the paladins, knights, and all that, but initially it was a little bit more Arthurian feeling even. So while we have scribes in the new games, we know people can go down the scribe path, but then go down the knight path. And then there are various levels of knights, various levels of scribes, and of course, elders above all of that. But it was a little bit more religious feeling in the early days where they were wearing robes. And here, they're actually calling him an elder cleric, and he's wearing robes.
Cleric, right.
And it seems like the scribes are a bit more, I think it's maybe a fine distinction, treating technology more as religion or like ancient religious knowledge versus ancient technical knowledge, kind of the same, but portrayed just a little bit different.
Like the difference between scribe and squire.
Yeah. And there's no reference at all to initiate.
That's never been mentioned, right? Which got to assume these aspirants are
initiates. I mean, that has to be a conscious decision to change that terminology. I wonder why they would do that. Interesting.
Yeah. So you become an initiate when you tell Dance that you'll join the Brotherhood.
Yeah. So any aspirant would be an initiate, right?
But these guys aren't necessarily in the Brotherhood yet.
But as it said, we gave you a name, we gave you food and all that. So you assume we're going to join up when they start studying and become aspirants, right? Like yeah. It's almost like an initiate.
You would think so.
Yeah. After the Knights show up and they see all this, we see them playing, what, do you call it basketball? B-O-S-ketball?
Yeah, they're throwing bricks into a milk crate. I mean, it's like the funniest game of basketball I've ever seen.
And this is where Maximus is on latrine duty. And you get the idea that Maximus is kind of not the favorite son. And his friend Dane, they convince him to go check out the power armor. So they're in there. This is when we see the 260s up close and they're talking about it. You realize he's really into it. And Maximus has been studying in a lot of ways.
And he has that flashback scene there of being rescued by the Brotherhood as a young child.
He's Billy.
Basically, yes.
He's kid in the fridge.
He has kid in the fridge for sure. It's a little bit Indiana Jones too, surviving in the fridge.
Yeah, exactly.
But this is when Dane is called to meet with the elder. And so we know that, because we know there's a big old conference with people from the East telling information. But also we're getting cuts over to the coolest thing, where they are getting transmission description of some kind of perpetrator they're looking for. And it's being plotted in like a dot matrix telegraph kind of thing. It's really neat.
Yeah, no, those are really awesome. Look sort of like the image shirts, dot matrix you get at the mall. You print your face on, put on a shirt or whatever. Those are cool. Yeah.
I thought the whole target transmission thing was just really neat.
Absolutely.
So the Knights coming in do have a mission to find this person who's been sent over. And there are, I think, at least five of them. We see five of them come out of the Pridwin. So now there's a huge force of Knights and Brotherhood personnel here because of the Pridwin's arrival. Because the Pridwin is essentially a mobile base. It's got a lot going on, as we've seen, like they did entire detachments to take over the Commonwealth in Fallout 4. So Dane's promoted to Squire. Everybody's celebrating that night. Maximus is a little bit unhappy about this. I mean, he's losing his one friend here. Like if he has one friend, it's Dane. And he's being passed over for promotion. You get a sense that this is happening a lot. And he just wants to get out there, be a Squire, help a knight.
He throws a little tantrum even.
And the next scene we cut to is in the barracks.
You mean the razor blade? I couldn't even tell what it was. The first time I saw it, I thought put something explosive in boot.
Right. So Maximus is in bed. Dane starts screaming. He jumps up and runs over, and foot is very bloody and cut up. And it looks like they're so bloody that you thought maybe there was an explosive or something.
Looks like she was
hit by a landmine.
I couldn't tell what happened there until I watched it a second time.
And it turns out somebody put a razor blade in their boot. And from there, from this scene, it cuts over. Boom, we cut back to the vault. Essentially, they're doing the cleanup. They've got some of the raiders locked up now, and they're going to try to interrogate them. And Lucy, of course, wants to go find her dad. We got to send a surface search party, get my dad back. And nobody seems to be into that. The council, they're like arguing with themselves. Betty stands up, and Betty says, keep it closed. You know, this is what opens us up to the danger of the wasteland. If we open that door, we're going to let the danger in. We can't let that happen. What happened to Vault 32, we don't want it to happen to us. And of course, her brother Norm whispers to her, they don't want to find dad. If they did, they wouldn't be in charge. I thought that was such a cool Vault politics moment. And it surprised me because everyone's been very worked together, happy-go-lucky, all that. And yet here,
that really stood out to me.
All of a sudden, you're like, okay, maybe. But it's also the fear of the outside, which you can see by the way that Hank was talking and the way that they live. That fear is greater than this, but also maybe they like being in charge.
It's a good revelation about the character her brother is. What's his name? Norm, you said?
Norm. He's the observant one. He can read people very well. But you also mentioned a lose your head reference.
There was a poster on the wall that said, don't lose your head. And lose your head is one of the repeating quests in Fallout Shelter. It's where the raiders ask you trivia questions about previous Fallout games.
That game
is called Lose Your Head. Just trying to catch every little tiny Fallout reference that they're dropping in. There's a billion goddamn Easter eggs in this show.
There are so many. We're seeing some of the furniture that's been in the games, 4 and 76. The kitty posters. We actually see the kitty paintings that you can put in your camp up on the wall, which, incidentally, those are actually Nate Perkypile's kittens. And now the paintings from in the game are on the walls. And that's just so cool.
Yeah, there was also a little Vault Boy bobblehead that was in one of the scenes in the vault. And that was a prop that was made by a community member.
Yeah. No way. That's great. Yeah.
It's neat. Throughout the show, we found out a number of times they ended up buying, like, sourcing props from people throughout the community. Yeah. Was that Mrs. Fallout who thought that was her bobblehead that she had sold to people for the show?
That's incredible. That sounds right. So hers was taken from the Big Gun's bobblehead, just with the Big Gun gone. And so that's what caught her attention.
That's awesome. But there are lots of little references there. So next scene we cut to Lucy and Norm and Chet. You actually first see Norm hanging up by the Nuka-Cola machine. And he's asking, like, how's your day or whatever? And the guy, he's like, everybody else, I'm doing awful. This is like the worst day ever. I thought that was hilarious. But meanwhile, he's just trying to make small talk to cover up the fact that Lucy and Chet are getting into the elevator to leave the vault.
Does someone else have access to opening the vault door? Is that why she needs Chet, or can anyone open that?
So we find out that Chet is the gatekeeper, which is why he was controlling the doors in between the vaults, and he's able to use the codes to get up to the elevator here. He has certain access codes that allow him to do that.
Okay. He and the overseer, but the other people probably wouldn't have that.
Right, exactly. Right. I mean, there may be a few others in the counselor who would never, you know, they wouldn't use it if they could. And it seems like he's kind of sort of hacking it, but also maybe trying to keep the alarm from going off. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So they get up out of the elevator and we see the door that's setting up to open. And of course, Chet has to help her actually open it. And he declares that she is not going alone and he is going with her. And Lucy is very prepared for this because she's not going to bring anyone else into danger with her. No more death. And also, I don't know if she's worried about Chet getting hurt or if she's worried that he'll just slow her down. But
she doesn't want to spend time with him. He's annoying. Annoyed by him, I should say.
You can tell he's a bit too much of a puppy dog for her. And that's not great. So she tranks him. He slumps down, which I thought this was neat because in all the pre-release stuff, the brief teaser, the shot of her leaving the door, we saw this body on the floor. What happened in this vault? Everybody fighting and now there's somebody dead on the floor. It was just Chet. He was just sleeping it off.
To be fair, Jess, there are about 30 dead people behind him, the floor, the compost room now.
Are they composting the bodies?
Did you see that? They were dragging the bodies to the compost room.
Yeah.
I mean, waste not, want not, I suppose. What else are they going to do? But, wow.
No, I heard you weren't supposed to compost meat. I don't know.
Thing is, this whole thing made so much more sense watching the show than all the speculation ahead of time, because speculation was rampant in the community. Like, is this the experiment? Because we saw a Vault Dweller and a Vault Dweller violence. Turns out it was Vault Dweller on Raiders. They weren't other Vault Dwellers from 32. But at the time, it looked like the vault was just going crazy. So we didn't know what was happening. So this makes a whole lot more sense. I like that kind of stuff with the promos where it makes you so curious, but a lot of it was misdirect, like the Pridwin.
Absolutely.
Jello cake. Anyhow, she tells Norm, you're not coming with me either. I hope you don't want to. And Norm says, he is too chicken. Oh, I'm too chicken. And just wishes her luck. And that is kind of foreshadowing, don't you think, Andrew, about the fact he has a bit of hero in him?
Like, if you watch enough TV series, you're like, okay, in the first episode, that guy is too chicken. By the end, he's going to be the hero. He's going to save the day in some fashion.
Right. So she leaves and they open the door. The classic step out moment in a way with the bright light. She steps out. The door closes behind her. And you just get such a gorgeous shot of the Vault 33 door. And it zooms out and you can kind of see that there are old skeletons here and bodies of people maybe trying to get in. It's just kind of a classic thing. You see her in other vaults and they zoom out and then you see the beach and Santa Monica Pier and all that. And that's really where you get the sense of location. It's a beautiful shot.
Yeah, I really like the juxtaposition of the most fun place on Earth that has like been demolished and is death and desolate. I always like that in the games. That's why places like, you know, Camden Park or Nuka World are super effective, because those are like, they're really fun places where these horrible things are happening. That juxtaposition is really useful in storytelling. I like that.
So back at the Brotherhood of Steel, we go to next, and Maximus is being interrogated. They assume he's the one who put the razor blade in Dane's boot. And so we kind of learn more about his character, some of what he's been through, some of how he feels. He's on the verge of breaking down here. You can tell that he thinks they're probably going to kill him for what they think he did, whether or not he did it. He's scared for his life. One thing I get about Maximus, even at the start here, and as it goes on, is that he is a very traumatized individual. He's had a hard life in the wasteland from childhood. We assume losing his family at the time and just everything he's been through to get here. The fact he's the whipping boy for some of the other aspirants. And I really felt for him, you know, there was part of me like, find your backbone and stand up. But at the same time, he's seeing everything he worked for, his little bit of hope going away. But essentially he says he didn't do it, but he wanted it to happen. Is that wrong? Now, do you guys think here that he did do it or no?
I didn't think so.
Okay. I mean, they certainly tried to plant that seed of doubt, but there wasn't really anything that gave any indication that he was that type of person.
Right. He seemed really sincere in his denial. Like,
and Dane was his friend.
I was just confused as to, like, if Dane is his friend, why did he want it to happen? Just because took the spot that he was wanting to take? Like, that's why he wanted...
I think he's admitting jealousy.
A true friend would want that to happen.
I think that's where we kind of get a hint at the fact that Maximus, while he is a better guy than some, we don't know that he's a good guy yet. We just know he's been through a lot. And I think it comes from a place of jealousy. So he doesn't acquit himself very well in the back and forth. And you worry, okay, he's going to be sentenced to something. But then the elder asks, does he have anything more to say for himself? And that's where he makes a stand. And he says, I want to thank you for my time here in the Brotherhood. And I want to help make the Brotherhood better. Even if it means giving up my own life, I'll do it. And I'd be grateful to the Brotherhood for giving my life meaning. That line right there, I think, is what clinches it. This was a job interview. He just got the job of being a squire. Okay, because even Dance would have been proud of that line. Grateful to the Brotherhood for giving my life meaning.
The elder nodded and was like, yep, nailed it, kiddo.
Yep. And behind him the whole time, there's a knight stalking. Like, the knight could basically at any moment reach out and crush his hand.
that was very intimidating. It was like stomping back and forth. Yeah.
Incredibly totally intimidating. Yep.
Yeah.
Just psychological pressure. But so he's promoted to being a squire. So he got what he wanted. For better or worse. Dane does say that they spoke up for him. And when they asked if they thought he did it, Dane said, I told them he wouldn't hurt a fly. Once again, we still don't know. We still don't know if he did and Dane's covering for him, if one of the other people did, but it seems like Dane at least wanted their friend.
Dane had a couple of stare down scenes where like eyeballs were locked in a fashion where I was like, Dane might be a little nuts. That was might have been a little foreshadowing too.
Yeah, quite possible. So there's a whole ceremony now where he's becoming a squire from aspirant. It's kind of a religious ceremony. They're in a bit of a church and he has to swear, take the oath to protect the Brotherhood first, protect the mission second, and protect your knight third, his knight being Titus in this case. And I believe it's Titus who brands him, but one of the knights heats up their gauntlet, power armor, and brands him, gets a T on the back of the neck.
Yeah, that's Titus. Was that ever mentioned in the game?
I don't remember them being branded. Do you?
I don't.
Because the knights didn't have squires assigned to them specifically.
Right.
There was no one in the field marching around with them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Dance has his team.
So squire a concept created by the TV show and they call them scribes in the game?
In the games, when we see squires, like in Fallout 4, they're usually younger, 12 to 14 year olds. Raised in the Brotherhood, and you're taking them out on missions.
Right.
So they're being trained, and they are going to support knights, but it's really just used for the younger members while they're learning and training before they can.
Yeah, in the TV show, they treat it more like a medieval knight,
right?
Right,
and they're squires.
It carries his lance around or whatever.
I saw a pretty funny comparison between the shot from Fallout. With the knight walking and the squire running behind with the huge bag. And then the shot from Monty Python where Arthur, the knight running around and his squire had a big giant bag.
Yeah.
The big old pack with the coconuts. Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of joking about the fact that we give all our companions all this loot to carry, but they're completely over cucumbered.
It's a good wink, you know?
It's funny that in the interview we were talking about earlier where Todd and Jonathan Nolan were speaking with IGN, Todd said there's something he'd like to take. I would really like to put that big old, he called it a golf bag, like giving the Squires a big old golf bag of weapons to lug around. He thought that was fantastic. So they're given their orders, and we now see in full the picture that was being done on the dot matrix telegram thing of the target. And it's Benjamin Linus. I'm lost. AKA, we know his name is actually Wilzig, and he's identified as an escaped Enclave scientist, which, hello, Enclave mentioned. We did not know at all if Enclave would even mention this thing, but apparently he's an escaped Enclave scientist. And his dog. In fact, they did a printout of a dog. I loved that. That was, you talked about how some things were goofy, and I mean, there was definitely goofy stuff in the vault. There wasn't as much with the Brotherhood, but yeah, that was hilarious. It's like getting a wanted poster at Scooby-Doo. Like, freaking awesome. But they have their mission, and Maximus will be accompanying Titus. So they get in the vertibird, they take off. There are some cool-ass vertibirds.
They look really nice.
Yeah.
I really like the way the power armor, how the power armor looks and sounds when it chunks around. The vertibirds look fucking awesome. The Pridwin looked cool as fuck. They're really nailing the visual aspects of the show.
And they actually fly in the direction they're supposed to. They're not going in circles, and they don't blow up. So I'm not sure it really is a vertibird.
They don't crash when they hit a cloud.
Apparently the pilots got a little better in the last 10 years. So let me see. We cut to the final scene of the show outside a castle, and a guy just kind of standing there, minding his business, guarding things. And then, thunk, he looks down, and there is a baby's leg protruding out of his tummy.
Then I was like, oh, yes, finally. Junk jet.
And it cuts to a group of three people coming in. This is where we first really get the Western theme, because we didn't have a Western theme from the Brotherhood or the vault at all. But here, it definitely has a Western feel all of a sudden. And one of them has a junk jet. And so as people who play the games know, the junk jet turns anything into a weapon, which kind of silly, because I mean, even getting hit at high velocity by Teddy Bear wouldn't normally kill you. But the junk jet does a decent amount of damage, in this case with a baby doll.
It'll make its baby doll leg implant itself into your sternum.
One can only assume there was a bit more of the doll that was actually dunked into him. But
you think the whole doll was implanted into his abdomen?
I mean, otherwise, how deep would that go? Like, just an inch?
I don't know. It
shouldn't have killed him. But
that'd be cool if the head was sticking out of his back.
But on top of the dog photo, this is probably the second most ridiculous moment, or maybe the most ridiculous moment, but it was funny. And you see the junk jet. It. And not everyone's a fan of the junk jet, but it's such a quintessential Fallout weapon. So it was cool to see.
What do you mean not everyone's a fan of the junk jet? Gee whiz.
Andrew, in our Facebook group, when we posted about it, some people were like, yeah, I didn't like that.
I'm offended.
You know, some people don't love the silliness.
That's the great part of Fallout is the darkness and the silliness.
So we see the group coming in, and the leader is talking about how Dom Pedro, who runs this place, has a captive here. And once a year, they dig him up to cut some pieces off and put them right back in the ground. And so you come up on, you realize that they're talking about a ghoul that his daddy used to work with back in the day, doing some bounties. And they come on this grave, and there's like an IV drip and tubes going down to the ground. And this is when you realize they're going to dig this guy up. Okay.
What is up with the IV drip?
Yeah, what is that? Do you think it's just nutrients?
It's the drug that keeps him from becoming feral.
So he has set that up himself.
No, Dom Pedro did.
Dom Pedro set it up so that he could torture him for years?
It's been a decade or two that Dom Pedro has had him. We think at least probably a decade. We don't know exactly. So the IV drip is either this drug that he takes, which we don't know anything about yet, or it's nutrients. And stuff just kind of like feeding him to stay alive, which you might say ghouls don't need to eat, but sometimes they do. The game, sometimes the ghouls need to eat, sometimes they don't. So who knows? Or it could be some kind of rat away or something to keep him under. Ray, I do like your theory. And I'm kind of thinking the same thing. It's such a different thing than we've seen before in the games that I don't know yet if that was it or not.
Yeah. Upon second watch, that's what I assumed it was. But, you know, first time, no, I didn't know because that wasn't a mechanic in any we'd ever seen in
the game. Right. Yeah, it wasn't part of the game.
So, of course, the hooligans coming in, they're worried, well, what if this guy's gone feral? You know, what if he's a feral ghoul? And this is where the head honcho says, that's why I brought a chicken. Ferals, they can't abide a chicken.
Which, what is that about? That has to be, that is so specific, that has to come from something.
I feel like it's got to just be local lore, some kind of wives' tale passed down by the guy, but it makes sense because chickens, they cluck, they move that neck. Ghouls, you know how they are about anything moving. So I could see a feral kind of losing it.
I just found it odd.
They raise the coffin with chains. He steps out dressed like a cowboy as he slowly comes to. Cowboy hat in hand that he quickly puts on his head. And yeah, he starts to talk. Apparently he is okay.
He goes and picks up the chicken.
They have a bit of a tete-a-tete, a little discussion about how they know who he is. And this is our introduction to the ghoul. Long story short, they tell him they've got a mission in California. They got a mission and maybe he'd be interested. And why would he be interested? Because from California.
He's from California. I thought that was a very tenuous connection. You know, that doesn't make much sense.
They probably know some stuff about his past, or at least what they know of his past. But would you say this is like Arizona, New Mexico? Any idea?
Yeah, might even be Mexico.
Why would you think that, Ray?
So the guy that gets shot by the baby leg is dressed very classically in Western movie Mexican outfit.
Okay.
The sombrero, the bandolier.
Really have all that on? I didn't notice that. That's hilarious. Yeah.
The vest with the embroidery on it.
And The guy that runs the castle, he was identified as Don Pedro.
Don Pedro.
You're right. It might be, do you think down like on the Baja Peninsula or something? What's that area called? Just south of California?
Yeah, Baja Peninsula.
So it could be Mexico, somewhere nearby, but outside of California proper at this point. Anyway, the ghoul is not having it. And he quickly dispatches of these guys. This is where you see very quickly. Yeah, he's incredibly skilled with guns, with tactics, takes everybody out, and throws the head honcho into the grave. Quite the scene.
I don't know. He was just talking about the philosophy of them cowboys. It's just right before he kills everyone. He's like, we cowpokes, we take it as it comes. I just thought that's so fucking typical Western, like very country Western typical lingo. And I was like, but what does that actually mean? We just roll with it. You know what I mean? That is such a good phrase. I love that.
Yeah, that is your first direct connection between Cooper Howard and the ghoul. Because that's the same line that he told his daughter when she was asking about the interaction that he had had with the dads.
Okay.
Right.
I didn't catch that. That's awesome. And I also, there's a point where they kind of say, but you're like us. And he says, no, I'm not like you. Because I do this for the love of the game. Because they're doing it for the caps, for the money, to get one big score and retire. And yeah, he says,
I kill for the love of the game.
And he had put down the chicken. He walks out of the compound in the dark. And it fades to black with the chicken clucking. And he didn't kill the chicken. He takes everybody else out, but he doesn't kill the chicken. He's not feral.
Really awesome. So,
yeah. And it ends with Crawl Out Through the Fallout.
Mm-hmm. Love it. And love it.
Just a great ending. You get all three characters. I do feel like, kind of sum up, they squeezed a lot into this first episode. The first episode is, I mean, it's over an hour. The ghoul scene is even pretty quick. Like, outside of the intro, how long do we have with the ghoul? Maybe 5 minutes in that scene total?
Oh, yeah. He's just barely at the end there, that final scene, right?
Love the use of the music. One thing to mention, we had talked last week about Philly and where the name came from. We mentioned Fillmore, other cities. Turns out, part of the lore of it that's not mentioned in the show, but you can see with stuff around it, it's built around a landfill. And that was mentioned as some pre-release stuff that is built around a landfill. And so it comes from the Phil. And at some point got changed to Philly over time.
Interesting.
I watched the episode with my wife, knows of the game, but knows nothing about the game. She enjoyed it. She said it visually, it was really impactful, intriguing to watch. She was confused about what happened to Lucy's dad because she saw him get shot and thought that he was dead. She didn't realize that those were tranquilizer dart. And then she had also talked her sister into watching it, who also isn't involved with it at all. She liked it too. She wonders if Lucy is pregnant with the Raider baby.
Absolutely is.
And they were both confused about the guy and his dog, how they were involved. But they thought the ghoul was definitely the best character.
Of course. He's charming AF, man.
We don't know anything about the escaped enclave scientist and the dog yet, but we will probably find out next episode.
Did they say something about him having like just an object that could put the U.S. in harm or save the U.S.?
Yes. Yeah. There's an object that could destroy or save us, something like that.
So it's good to hear non-Fallout people could kind of follow. Did anyone else watch with someone who wasn't as familiar with Fallout? Like Andrew, did you watch with Tori or anything?
Tori, you know, was in and out a little bit and watched some of it here and there. And she was asking lots of questions like, what's that and who's that and what do they do? So I could tell that it was intriguing to her as well. I told her that she should go back to episode one and start it. She's in the middle of something now, so, but I don't know. Maybe I'll try when she's at the end of what she's watching and be like, hey, you should watch that Fallout show. Maybe she'll be intrigued enough to watch it.
I was at one of my brother-in-law's had a baptism, his baby's baptism Sunday, and we had a family celebration afterwards. And my other brother-in-law, he came up to me, all sorts of questions. He doesn't know Fallout at all, plays no video games at all, but we talked Fallout for hours about the show and stuff. He was interested, and he's really cool. And he had all the same questions, like, how did they not notice right away when they came out the vault that they were all dirty and stuff? He was all confused. Like, they're just naive vault dwellers, you know, I don't know, stuff like that. And he had the questions, and he seemed, trying not to spoil anything for him, he seemed to really, really want to know what's going to happen with Cooper Howard. Like, where do they run off to with the girl? And he wanted to get into that backstory a lot. And
so, right.
Yeah.
A lot of my friends have watched it, too. A good friend of mine mentioned never played any of the games, really enjoyed the show, wants to watch more. I am seeing, like we saw talking the numbers earlier on the regular podcast, that a lot of people are checking out the games, either going back to them or checking them out for the first time based on the excitement from the show. And it's already renewed for a second season. So that is really exciting. But I think it did a good job laying out the world, laying out the difference in the three characters, giving us a little bit about them. I mean, only a very little about the ghoul so far. But enough to know he is a cowboy badass and at one point was an actor. Any other lore issues or references you guys saw you wanted to bring up?
When you're a TV cowboy, are you actually good at shooting and stuff?
Some can be, right?
Was he a real cowboy first or he was an actor who became
he was also a TV cowboy?
Yeah, okay.
He was a Marine, so.
And you know, if you think about like Roy Rogers and some of those cowboys from that era, they didn't have stuntmen, you know, like they do now that do everything for you. So a lot of those guys did do a lot of that work themselves.
Nice.
Yeah, that makes sense. You would assume a lot of these actors who were also great at stuff like that had some ranch experience. Oh, it's interesting. It's mentioned in chat that many movie cowboys had served in World War II at the time, too, that like, it's actually kind of historically accurate that some of the big actors in the cowboy movies had been in the military prior. Let's see. Anything else? You guys want to wrap it up?
Yeah, I think this one definitely left a lot of questions. You got the introduction to these people, but it left you clamoring for the next episode because there was just so much that wasn't, you're like, I need to find out more about this stuff. This is not enough.
Yeah, those of us who know the wasteland, I mean, we were excited to see all the things we knew, but so many questions about why is this vault a little bit different? The Brotherhood of Steel, okay, this chapter is a bit more, like I think I mentioned before, reminds me of the first games a little bit more. We'll see more next episode. But while they talk about technology, the ones we meet so far are mostly jerks, which some people think is normal. But they're usually not quite this jerkish. So, but then you realize that always.
I can't believe how many people are surprised about how the Brotherhood is represented in this show. I'm like, seems pretty accurate to me.
But all we meet so far are the aspirants who aren't necessarily full members sworn in yet. And then pretty much the elder. Nobody else really talks from the Brotherhood. So we don't really know if a lot of them are more advictorium and it just hasn't come through yet or not.
Really enjoy the first episode. I've watched the whole first season, but I'm really enjoying going back through individually and really trying to pay attention to the nooks and crannies.
They set the tone really well. What Absolutely. We saw so far, some great cinematography, and I really like the contrast switching from the really intense opening to the humor in the vault, and then how that went a totally different direction after a bit. And then the Brotherhood part was by far the most stark you get a sense of wasting life, at least in this section of the Brotherhood, being very harsh.
Would you guys change anything about the show?
In this first episode? No, I might have them show a little bit more of the Brotherhood to really establish who they are. But we get enough to know their military, their training, and they care about technology, which those are the important parts.
I would have liked to have heard more Anansur score.
Maybe. Yeah, right? In this first episode, for sure. Because we might get it later, but we don't hear.
You guys are asking for more and more. I'm kind of asking for less. I felt like, even though I was entertained the whole time, that's a little long for a first episode. Give me a tight 52-minute episode and out. You know what I mean?
A lot of times that first episode pilot tends to be like a double episode.
A little movie, you know what I mean? Yeah.
This one lived up to that.
But I think the last 12 minutes of it was credits.
Yeah, it does seem like after you get the cool end credit scenes on each of these, like you've got full credits and then multiple, they do it in multiple languages.
Yeah.
I think that's an Amazon Prime thing.
Yeah, and heaven help you if it's a dub show, because then they give you the credits for all of the dub actors that make it into a different language shows. The credits just keep going and going and going.
Well, thanks so much all for tuning in with us and listening to this episode of Vault Talk, talking through episode one, The End. I do like that. Like, that was clever. The end being the end of the world, but also the beginning of our show. So that was really great. This episode was a little more of a recap. We'll probably go a little bit less blow by blow in the future, but we were just excited about introducing all of our characters and concepts. Thank you for listening, and we will see you in the Wasteland.